I want to start this morning by thanking men who meet together on Wednesday mornings for a Bible study here. The Road Crew is a group of fathers mostly in this church, not entirely. There are younger folk and those who haven't had children, but the majority are fathers. And on Father's Day, I want to thank them for their help to me in thinking through these studies in Proverbs. We have worked on this for some months, knowing that I was going to preach on it. And so I'm really thankful for their help and want to commend them. Let me also say that this summer we are planning a series that is very much like Proverbs, men talking about what they've learned, the life skills they've gained, and different ones sharing throughout the summer. So I really do want to invite you to come to the Road Crew on Wednesday mornings. Starting June 29th, that is a week from this coming Wednesday, we're going to kick off the summer with a pancake breakfast. 6:30 is when we start, but it should be a great time, and I hope you'll join us for the summer. And again, thanks to you guys who are here for your help. June is the month in our calendar, our culture's calendar, in which graduations of all sorts take place. And I'm struck, you know, listening to the graduation speeches, commencement speeches I've heard over the years, but as well to records of some that have been given this year, struck with how much the commencement speaker is basically a proverbist, if you will, someone who is, in almost every case, giving wisdom that comes from having lived life. And so here stands the commencement speaker before the gathered eager minds, saying what's a good idea and what isn't a good idea into the future. That's very much the style of the Proverbs as well. And the passage we're going to start with this morning is in chapter 31, and it has the same quality to it. A speech being given in which a bad idea is elucidated, a good idea is elucidated, and the hearers are urged to take the good path rather than the bad path. Here we stand at a momentous time in life, and you're on life's journey, and you're at a fork in the road, and here are all the bad ideas, and here are the good ones, and you should choose the good ones. That's the form of the speech, sort of like you might hear it at any of a number of commencements. And I don't remember a single thing I've ever heard at a commencement speech I've been at, but hopefully this will be a bit more memorable. It's another twist on this is the 31st chapter of Proverbs is a speech given by a woman, a mother, on Father's Day. So we'll just have that as kind of a quirk of the moment. I want to start in verse 4 of chapter 31. It's not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink wine, not for rulers to crave strong drink, lest they drink and forget what the law decrees and deprive all the oppressed of their rights. Then jumping down to verse 8. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. Now, if we were to take the whole context here, Lemuel's mother is speaking to him as a king, or probably one about to take his place as king in whatever kingdom it is. No one knows who these people are. They don't have any, they're nowhere else in Israel's history. Probably this is a very small little kingdom of some sort in the ancient world. Lemuel is about to ascend to the throne. His mother is giving him a speech. And basically, it's, as I said, it has the form of the commencement address. At the fork in the road, this is a bad idea. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's sort of, if you looked at the whole context, that's what she's saying. These are bad ideas. Don't go there. Don't dissipate your life. Don't live for self-indulgence and pleasures and all of those things. Kings don't live like that. You should, on the other hand, take this road as king and speak up for those who have no voice. Defend those who are destitute and poor and needy. Insist on fairness. Care for those who need your care. That's the way kings live. Now, the concern raised here for the destitute, for justice, for fairness, for raising those who are oppressed, for caring for those in difficulty, is a huge subject matter, isn't it? It's complex. Even 3,000 or more years ago, when this these words were written, or at least collected, It was complex then. How does one help out those whose lives are in difficulty? What sort of structural changes need to be made? How do decisions get made so that real help is given instead of enablement? And on and on and on. The issues of poverty are complex, were complex then. They're vastly more complex now. The Earth's population is staggeringly larger in the number of people that live on this planet, so much larger now than was true in the time of, in biblical times. The sheer numbers are overwhelming. The technology we have for knowing about poverty and injustice and destitution also makes it impossible to ignore what's going on. There are billions who live in difficult circumstances, billions of souls on this planet, and we can be informed at almost a moment's notice about virtually the condition of all of them. We have instantaneous and aggressive technology that speaks about the people of the earth. And you could make a list. I made one. I'm going to read it just in a second. You could make one of your own of all the things that have been brought to your awareness, the hard and difficult circumstances of life. Consider starvation and genocide in Africa, traffickers and immigrants who leave them to die of exposure in the Arizona desert, unborn infants near and far deemed unworthy of life, Christian minorities who are persecuted in Muslim countries, sex slavery in Southern Asia, political corruption in urban centers that allow violent gangs to abuse poor neighborhoods, populations devastated by AIDS, hurricanes, tsunamis, and other natural disasters. The responsibility of the king is to care about those and act and speak up on behalf of those who are in need. But how to take a step forward? What's the right thing? Where do we start? How do we begin to unravel the complexities that we're faced with? There are so many voices calling for this or that course of action, this or that analysis of the problem, this or that large responsibility or small responsibility. We've had the same problem in some of the other messages we've been considering in Proverbs. Last week we talked about the power of the tongue, the power of speech to change things, beginning with the Logos of God Himself, the very Word of God who became flesh and dwelt among us. It's an enormously powerful, inspiring, world-changing authority, the gift of speech, and how will we use our tongues and so on. It's a big idea. It's a complex idea. And yet what the Proverbs do for us is break it down into manageable steps forward. An indication to do this or not do that, to embark on this course, to make this choice rather than another one. What the Proverbs do that help us is put things kind of on a low enough shelf that we can begin to say, yeah, I can go there. I can start there. I can act that way. I can make that choice. And so I hope it will be the same in this morning's consideration, that we will find some hook, some step, some platform by which we can act, we can see ourselves, we can start making choices. You know what we'll discover, of course, is that as we begin a journey, God goes with us and He opens doors and He makes a way and He gives us a place to have impact and He allows our lives to make a difference. And rather than being daunted by the impossibility of the huge, we find a way to use the gifts He's given us, the relationships He's given us, the place He's given us, and He will make a difference using our lives. There are a couple points I want to make before we put some of the Proverbs up on the screen in just a moment, and we're going to talk through just a series of these specific short steps that are advocated. Another word of background is God has a bias in this. He has a perspective in everything we're going to talk about. And His starting point is that all of us are the same. We live in a world in which every person is graded higher or lower, prestigious or less so, important or unimportant, rich or poor, high status, low status, educated, uneducated, on and on. We grade each other on all these things. God doesn't care about any of them. Every single human soul he's made has his devotion and love and esteem. And so we need to treat one another as equals, to recognize that every single person has the same status and should be enabled, given opportunities that are equal and care and so on. God's involved. He notices. He pays attention. The choices and struggles of every single one in this life are of concern to him. And that should inform our thinking as we begin. A second thing I would say comes out of Lemuel's mother's speech to Lemuel. And that is, she was raising a king. And she told her son, as king, you should act this way. You have from the beginning a responsibility for nobility, for royalty, for responsible action. Your life should matter. You are a king, destined to be a king, and a royal future is one that you should take seriously. Well, it turns out that's the biblical perspective. That's the gospel perspective for every one of us as well, isn't it? Kings is of either gender. Kings is what God makes. What's what we were saved for, to live lives of consequence and noble purpose, to be part of something important, to play a role that's necessary. You have royal standing. You have a destiny that's as important as Lemuel's mother's destiny articulated for her son. Our lives are supposed to count. Last thing I would say by way of background, again from the word given by Lemuel's mother, is the responsibility to speak up for those who have no voice. There are people everywhere in this world, near and far, who need an advocate, who, for whatever reason, are not given the opportunity to speak, whose voice is muted, whose struggles are drowned out by other things. They need someone to speak for them. And over again, we will have opportunities, as we let God lead us, we'll have opportunities to take up the cause of someone who won't be listened to otherwise. And if our voice will be listened to, that's the call, the responsibility we have. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Well, first, let me put the first set of specific proverbs before you on the screen, and we'll consider them. These have to do with fairness in life. Again, from verse 9 of chapter 31 of Proverbs, speak up and judge fairly, we are told. And fairness is equity, a level playing field. Kind of an honest dealing with one another must be the beginning point for setting things right. Things that are broken, in order to be set right, the environment has to be one that's fair and just and equal for everybody. We know from earlier studies in Proverbs that sometimes lives turn out differently, even if they begin at the same point. They begin with the same opportunities. The classic example is laziness versus diligence. That's a big part of Proverbs. And sometimes people who are diligent and hardworking and disciplined and care about things, they end up with a life that looks like this. And some who are self-indulgent and lazy end up with a different kind of life. And outcomes aren't always equal, but opportunity should be. The game shouldn't be rigged to start with. There shouldn't be populations of folks that, no matter what's in their heart or what effort they expend or what concerns they have or choices they make, will fail no matter what because everything is stacked against them, while others whose hearts are cold, who are uncaring, who are self-impressed, people who gain all the advantages because the game is rigged in their favor, versus those who have no opportunity because it's rigged against them. That's the issue that these proverbs speak to. And let me read the first of them. Proverbs 16:11 says this: honest scales and balances are from the Lord. All the weights in the bag are of His making. The picture, of course, is of a scale, a measuring device would be used in transactions and in the ancient world. It's the picture of the woman justice with the blindfold over her eyes holding the scale that has a balance beam on it. And you'd have weights in a bag, a merchant's bag or a deal maker's bag, and you'd put some weights on one side and then you'd value something on the other. And you can't have two sets of weights. You can't use one measurement for this group of people and a different measurement for that group. All the weights in the bag are the Lord's. He wants us to treat one another honestly, to speak honestly, to judge fairly, to measure things the same for everybody. I don't know how you'd feel about people cutting in line. You know how I feel about it? I know exactly how I feel about it. I like it when I'm the cuttee. You know, are we going to get in the movie? I don't know. We're late. Oh, somebody's up in front of the line. We'll just slip in. It's a great deal when you're the person that's for whom it works. I hate it when I'm the person toward the back that's being disadvantaged by the injustice, the unfair treatment. If you've raised more than one child, there is a phrase with which you will be very familiar here many times during the day, more than you ever want to hear again if you've been raising children very long. It's the phrase, "It's not fair. It's not fair. It's my turn, not her turn. I deserve the opportunity this time. I should get to watch my TV show. I should have the extra dessert. I should be..." Whatever. It's not fair. Children have an enormous capacity to have very graded, finely graded responses as to whether fairness is occurring. And it always occurs when the phrase is always championed when you're the one who's taken it with the short straw. You're the one who's being disadvantaged. Hardly anybody, I've never heard a child, mine or any other, say, "It's not fair," meaning I've got too much. You know, please let the other person go first. I've never come, you know, it's never like that, is it? Kings, however, will insist on fairness even when it concerns them not at all, when they are neutral, when it's somebody else's life and somebody else's opportunity, and they'll speak up for those who are disadvantaged and will balance the scale rightly against those who are taking advantage of others. You know what kings will even do? They will even, as they trust God and become who they're called to be, they will even give up their rights and their advantages and their the rigging of the game in their favor in order to make it fair for other people. There are places in the world where housing is rationed and medicine is rationed and educational opportunities are rationed, but there's not enough to go around. Those who know and love God will try and make the rationing of scarce resources fair for everybody rather than only for those who are already born with life's goods. One last thought on fairness, honest balances. I remember when one of our children, this is a young child, so this is fairly early in the sports competition world. One of our children had played sports, and I was involved on some kind of secondary level in helping out with whatever the sport was. And I'm not going to be too precise here, lest anybody come back to ask me about it. And the deal was we're going to choose an all-star team at the end of the season for our league to play against other all-star teams. And there was all these people, you know, team moms and assistant coaches, and all these people that had been involved. And there was supposed to be this large meeting. We had a big room. We're going to pick an all-star team, and we had statistics and who played the most and who had improved the most. And there's all this long discussion, and, you know, this big meeting would happen, and an all-star team would get chosen. And we're all sitting around, and then we realized there was another room where three guys came out who had been having a private meeting all along while the rest of us were waiting. And it became obvious within 30 seconds that the whole thing was rigged. They knew who the all-stars were going to be. They had already made the choices, biased everything. They had kind of run... There was a pretense that it was this objective and, you know, community-wide choice, but it wasn't at all. And again, just to say how, you know, the struggle you have, all of us will have with fairness, is my first reaction was, this isn't right. My second reaction was, is my kid chosen or not? And that was more important. If the game is rigged and I and my kid comes out ahead, you know, I'm not going to fight too hard for justice. It's not right, but does it advantage or disadvantage me, was the question. The king, the royal son, those who have God's mind will want a level playing field for everyone. Psalm 10, or verse 10 of Psalm 20, or excuse me, Proverbs 23:10. Do not move an ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the fatherless, for their defender is strong. He will take up their case against you. There are too many people in our world and everywhere in the world that have, as they become old and frail and struggle to advocate for themselves, get taken advantage of by others. Elder abuse is one of the big problems that has been written more and more about recently, where folks who live at some distance from their family, who can't take care of themselves, who are confused as they get older and unsure of themselves, will have somebody take over their assets for them and manage them and warehouse them sometimes and accept the checks that come their way and not pass on any of the benefits. They're crooks, abusers of the elderly. That's what I think is in mind here by the moving of an ancient boundary stone. Someone who has means but has it taken from them because they can't defend themselves anymore. The fatherless, the widowed, the confused, the depressed, who have people prey on them because they can't speak up for themselves anymore. They have a defender. They have someone who notices. Someone who'll put things right. Don't move the ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the fatherless. I think sometimes the bureaucracies that are so off-putting to people that don't know English very well or haven't got PhDs and the chance, you know, kind of the savvy with how things work. How do you get your kid into a hospital when they're sick if the bureaucracy sort of looms too hard to work your way through? How do you ask for your child to give a chance to get into the school that they might have the right to get into, but there's a scramble for places, and it's the aggressive and the well-connected that seem to end up at the front of the line. The legal system, the educational system, medicine, there's all sorts of fields where there's so much bureaucracy, so much jargon, so much special knowledge that's required that those who don't have everything to start with end up with less at the end. Don't move the ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the fatherless. Proverbs 17:23, a wicked man accepts a bribe in secret to pervert the course of justice. Secrecy is, I think, very often the enemy of justice. Insider trading and slush funds and false documents and cooked books and all of those things happen in secret, away from the eyes of those who know that it appears to be an open opportunity, but in fact it's not at all. Everything's been shuffled around behind closed doors ahead of time. One of the things I appreciate so much about this church and its leadership and its history is, with all the quirks and all the struggles we have here, decisions get made essentially out in the open. They get made by a group of people, not one or two. They get made in public discussion most of the time. And even when things have to be sort of held in some confidence for a while, they're that's not long and it's not many. And the sense that we ought to live our lives with unveiled face, as the Apostle Paul would say, that we ought to live out in the open, is a strong value. And I think God has saved us for a long time from doing things that we would regret because of a sort of bias against secrecy. But it's tempting, always tempting, to sort of get stuff done behind closed doors. So the king will advocate for fairness, for equality, for removing privilege from some and handing and raising up others so that they are have the same possibilities, the same chances as everyone else. The other issue, that a further set of Proverbs that I think speak of another some other responsibilities of the king are the requirement that in order for justice, in order for compassion, in order for actions that mirror God's heart for those in need to occur, we have to be near one another. You can't make things right of this sort from a distance. That in the long run, the chasm between the rich and the poor, the chasm between the haves and the have-nots, the distance from those who are protected and secure and have all of life stuff, the distance that it exists between them and those who have little, it needs to be bridged in order for anything good to happen. Proverbs 22:2 says this: "The rich and the poor have this in common: the Lord is the maker of them all. He does not distinguish between those who are rich and those who are poor." No one in this room is self-made. We have a maker. The opportunities we've been given were given to us by Him. The mind, the skills, the chances to do well, the inclination to act on those chances, those are all a gift from someone. We have not accomplished anything good and in a setting that we can take credit for it as if it were our own doing and only our own doing. The poor are made by the same one who made us, and He loves them as much as those of us in this room who have life's advantages. This is a great call to thankfulness instead of pride. What we have, we've been given, and we should be grateful, and we should also incline ourselves towards those who are set up off from us, perhaps by kind of the way the world gets arranged. 14:31, "The one who oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God." The way you treat the poor is the way you treat their maker, don't forget. How does kindness occur? You can be well-intentioned from a distance. You can even be generous from a distance, but you can't be kind unless you're near somebody. Those who are kind to the poor, you have to know somebody in order to be kind to them. You have to know what's going on in their life. You have to understand the pressures and the fears and the struggles. You have to understand the number of times that hopes have been raised and dashed. In order to be kind to someone, you have to know when you're being manipulated. Sometimes just acting on a request is the worst thing you can do for someone. You're just enabling bad patterns that exist. How do you know what's right for someone? How do you know what's kind and genuinely helpful? You got to know the person. And if we would bless the one who has made them, we have to have some relationships that are genuine enough and long-standing enough and honest enough that we can be kind rather than just well-intentioned. 17:5, "The one who mocks the poor shows contempt for their maker. Whoever gloats over disaster will not go unpunished." Most people I know, people here in this setting, are not grotesque and crude and sort of laughing at poor people, handicapped people, mocking in the most childish sort of way. But ignoring folks, turning away from them, failing to see them, can be a form of mockery, can't it? Being uncomfortable and sort of steering around them is a form of mockery, it seems to me. What about the unattractive people, shy people, the awkward people, the social misfits, the depressed people, the people who sort of lead with their pain? Just soon not have that conversation. And yet, in doing so, there's a kind of mockery, a kind of rejection, a kind of putting aside. And their Maker is observing and caring and receiving our choices for those that He has made and loved. 21:13. If a man shuts his ears to the cry of the poor, he too will cry out and not be answered. Strikes me that people most often shut their ears when they're talking too much. It's true of me. I don't listen very well when I'm doing all the talking, when I'm having all the opinions, when I'm making all the plans, when I'm taking charge of things. And I think the church historically has made a lot of mistakes when it thinks it has the answers. Christian communities, Christian groups, Christian people. When we lead with the answers and we lead with the information and we lead with the good ideas and we don't take the time to listen. It's very indicting, I think. A study that was done some years ago that I read that said that Christian churches were among the most resistant folks in our culture to refitting their buildings for handicapped people. Now, some of the churches were the oldest buildings around, and it was more difficult and so on to refit for wheelchair access and other kind of handicapped access. But the strongest antagonist to laws requiring opportunity and openness and, you know, inclusion of handicapped folks were Christian churches. And a lot of them had a lot to say, I'm sure, but didn't listen very well to hear how they sounded and hear those who were asking to be included and weren't. If you shut your ears to the cry of the needy, we will cry out, maybe cry out in our prayers. And it will seem as if God is not listening. We began our discussion, our consideration, by noting that God intends us to live like kings. That He has called us His own. He has named us sons and daughters of the very sovereign of the universe Himself. And He intends for His royal children to live like kings. And what kings do most of all is care for those who don't have enough, who tell the truth, who speak for fairness, who defend the rights of those who are in need. You know what is also true? Two things, quickly. The advocacy for other people is a lot more interesting than pampering yourself. The times I find myself most bored and frustrated with my life are the times when I'm most focused on myself. I just can't make myself happy enough. All the efforts I make to pamper myself and protect myself and take care of myself and observe myself are the most boring things I do. The most engaging, the most interesting, the most alive are the choices to find someone else that has needs and advocate for them. The last thing I would say in this is that we discover God in acting this way. We find Him in places and see Him in ways and discover truth about Him that we would not otherwise. We make connections to God because He's involved and He's aware and He is concerned and He is present. We find ourselves more in love with Him, more inclined to worship. I want to close with Jesus' words about surprising those who loved Him. Words offered at the end. The king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." May we hear the surprising commendation of the Lord someday. Royal sons and daughters, who've learned to act in ways of characteristic justice and compassion and involvement, so much so that we don't realize we're doing it even at times, so much so that we are blessing our Lord and who will someday speak to us of the lives we've lived. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the simple wisdom of Proverbs about fairness and honesty and listening and choosing. Set our feet on a good course, Lord, and help us discover you in the process, we pray. Amen.